From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for joining us for our weekly review of Connections. It's not often that we get to sit down with a relative of Gandhi. This week, we welcomed Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, and the author of a new book about the gift of anger. Arun Gandhi is helping mark what would have been his grandfather's 150th birthday with some public conversations about anger. He says the country is going through a polarized period, but it's possible to turn anger into something positive.
Anger can offer opportunities if we know how to look for them. But, you know, we get angry and we lose it. We go crazy and we are not in control of our minds. And because we are not in control of our mind, we tend to abuse that anger rather than find solutions to it. So what we need to do is to, first of all, learn to control our minds. That when we get angry, we don't lose our minds. And that means, doing some mental exercises, which my grandfather made me do. Sitting in a room quietly every day for a few minutes, hold in front of me something that gave me pleasure to look at. Focus on that object for 1 minute and then close my eyes and see how long I can keep that image in my mind's eye. In the beginning, I found that I couldn't keep that image long enough. I mean, the moment I closed my eyes, the image vanished because I had no practice. I had no control over my mind. But when I began to do this exercise regularly every day, I found that I could keep that image longer and longer in my mind. And the longer you can keep that image in your mind, the greater control you have over your mind. So when you get angry or when you face a situation, you don't lose your mind, but you find ways in dealing with that issue in an intelligent way.
Do you think too many leaders in people in positions of power want the general population to be angry? Do you think that it is profitable, and I don't just mean money, I mean influence and power and control, it is profitable for those with power to keep most of us angry at one another?
Yes, that's the divide and rule policy. Let the people fight among themselves. They raise all these issues of black and white and poor and rich and all of these things to keep the pot boiling, and we fight among ourselves while they rule. That's the whole divide and rule policy of politics there. But, this whole materialistic lifestyle that we have chosen depends entirely on control by fear. And the more fear you can instill on people, the more control you have over them. So the politicians control us through fear. The religious leaders control us through fear. Everybody who wants to control the community controls through fear. We do that at home with our children. Every time we threaten our children with punishment, we are controlling them through fear. Because we are the parents, we have the ability to punish them. They have to behave, they have to listen to us. So that whole mindset, which has developed into a whole culture of violence, is what is corrupting our societies today. What we need to do is to learn to control people through love and respect and not through fear. And that starts at home, the way we parent. Yeah, I was, brought up in a nonviolent home, and my parents didn't believe in punishing us. We did misbehave, my two sisters and I, but we were not punished. They did penance. Depending on how serious the offense was, they would fast for a day or 2 days. They would sit at the table, they would feed us, but they would tell us that they are not going to eat because they were not good parents and they didn't teach us the right way of behavior. And because the relationship between the parents and us was built on respect and love for each other, we felt awful when they had to do such things. And we made sure that next time we didn't do it. So that is what we need to be conscious about and build there. But as long as we submit to fear at any level there, we are submitting to violence. And, you know, when we speak of violence, we speak only in terms of the physical violence mm-hmm. that we experience. But there is the passive violence, the non-physical violence that we commit all the time, which is what fuels the physical violence. So physical violence doesn't come of its own. It is fueled by the passive violence that is practiced in society.
Let's turn to the Harvey Weinstein trial. This week, a jury convicted the Hollywood producer of two felony counts, including rape. He'll spend up to 29 years in prison. In this clip, you'll hear Lauren Berger, a training coordinator for Restore Sexual Assault Services. But first, here's Willow Domestic Violence Center CEO Megan DeChateauvieux. They both describe their reaction to the guilty verdict and what it means going forward.
I felt an overwhelming sense of relief. And I think it seems like it's been going on a lot longer than even just the trial. It seems like I've been hearing about this for a long time. And to have it come to this conclusion was just really validating, empowering. It felt like at this point, finally, women's voices and survivors' voices are being heard and listened to by this jury. So I was surprised to see how long it took for deliberations, but I did feel an overwhelming sense of relief.
Lauren, what did you think?
Similarly to when we have cases that are resolved on a more local level, there's sort of a myriad feelings. There's relief at the closure of sort of the process. There is a sense of justice for some, you know, that there's finally accountability for somebody who for a long time thought that they could assault people with impunity. And there's still some that feel that there's more to be done and sort of maybe not enough justice, or that they don't feel justice was done. And that can be different for different people depending on, you know, what justice looks like for them. Sometimes people want to see very punitive measures and they feel that, you know, no punitive punishment is essentially going to be good enough. And there are others who are looking for maybe, you know, financial compensation for pain or losses that they've suffered in other ways. Others turn to kind of other forms of justice outside the criminal justice system. But in this case, it really did feel relieving to have kind of this piece of the process completed, and to know that, I think it was Tom Hanks, as I was listening to some of the news timelines as kind of preparing for this before I came in, he was the one that told the BBC that Harvey Weinstein captured a moment in time. There was a before and an after in terms of our understanding of this issue and how we kind of process when these things happen, not only for the people that are directly involved, but what they mean for our own lives and people we know.
I want to ask you, Lauren, and frankly, I want to ask both of you, if you view this as this one-off case, a high-profile, singular case, or if this does represent something different, as Deborah Turkheimer, the law professor at Northwestern, told the Times, a test case of what happens not just to one person or with one set of allegations, but when an entire culture begins to shift. Lauren, yes or no?
I think in many ways we can say yes, because we're in a time now where many people have the chance to weigh in and how they're impacted by this via social media and talking to other people in ways that people can produce content in ways they couldn't in the past decades. And Harvey Weinstein's case, for both the proximity that a lot of people felt because they were celebrities, and for various reasons people feel connected to different celebrities through affinities of certain kinds, and because he came to light and sort of all these different instances came to light when #MeToo was really capturing a consciousness on its own, and because his trial has had this sort of lifespan in this couple of years of this nuanced of understanding where we can have these conversations on social media or through mediums like this, there's been a sort of evolution in how we understand accountability and what it means to protect certain things over others, and a real, certainly maybe on an individual level, a referendum on what it means to have had the culture we've been in for so long. And we see different laws shifting in that regard, mm-hmm. as far as harassment and workplaces and different policies, different litigation options being opened up for survivors. So in some ways, I think there's really direct implications that this is more than just an isolated case.
Next, here's a word we're seeing more and more: intersectionality. Do you feel comfortable defining it? If not, you're not alone. Here's SUNY Brockport professor Milo Oborn, the chair of the Department of Women and Gender Studies, discussing a term that is often misunderstood.
I don't actually think intersectionality is about an adding up of oppressions. However, I understand where that comes from, because the term was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, and she's a Black feminist thinker, and it's coming out of a long discussion primarily among Black feminist thinkers about why talking about just sexism and just racism is a problem, because Black women's concerns don't get addressed within that dominant model, right? So the way we use the term now is coming out of this history of thinking, but it's very much not, in Crenshaw's argument, an argument about sexism plus racism, right? It's not like I experienced this one oppression and then another one on top of it, another one on top of it. But what she's saying is that Black women experience sexism differently as it intersects with a racial identity, right? Which also means that white women experience sexism differently as it intersects with white identity, right? She's using an example of somebody who's multiply marginalized, but that idea actually can be extrapolated into everyone's identities, right? Every single person has intersecting identities, and those are all related to these broader systems of oppression. So I actually think it's a really generative kind of idea that is not to say, well, you have more oppression than me, and so, you know, I can't address what you're experiencing because I haven't experienced it, but rather the same systems of power that impact you also impact me. So all of our various identities fall under the same systems. Therefore, if we're trying to change those systems, we all have an investment in getting them to change. We may talk about this later, but I'll just use it as an example. The breakout session that I'm going to do on Saturday is about cisnormativity and cissexism, and just about thinking, you know, the way that we often think about trans exclusion or transphobia is there are trans people, their needs need to be addressed. And then oftentimes when we talk about intersectionality, we say, well, in addition to trans needs, we also have to think about trans women's needs, or we also have to think about trans people of color's needs. That version, I think, actually does become a problem, because then you just start listing all of these various identities and it feels impossible to address them. But if we kind of take a step back and say, like, okay, well, how has cisnormativity or cissexism, the structure underlying transphobia, impacted all of us in various ways, having to do with our racial identities, our gender identities, whether we're cis or trans, then we can start getting people into the conversation in a way that says, like, okay, we need to dismantle these ways of thinking, these things that underlie a lot of our policies, the ways that we think about identity, so that we don't end up with this idea that there's one oppressed identity and we just have to fix the things for it, but that we all have investments in undermining, dismantling systems of oppression from our various locations. Does that make sense?
Sure. And Professor, do you see the public discourse on intersectionality effectively understanding that nuance, or do you think it sometimes sort of devolves into this bad faith stuff?
No, I see it devolving all the time. And I think it's really important to acknowledge. And as you said, even if the basic acknowledgement is just that we have multiple, you know, identities, and we shouldn't be, if we're talking about LGBT rights, we can't only be talking about white middle class people. That's important as a starting point. But I think it doesn't really get us as far in our political activism as this more nuanced kind of power-based structural understanding.
Who do you blame most for the bad faith?
I don't even know how to answer that question. I think people are trying to do good work, and sometimes, myself included, we hear something and we understand a part of it and we want to use it without necessarily kind of thinking through. So this goes back to the historical piece. For me, the history of language, the history of the ways that these concepts have come into our vocabulary, the people who originated them, kind of going back to those articles, going back and reading Kimberly Crenshaw and really thinking about what she's talking about, and then using it in your work is important. When terms become too popular, we lose that sense of kind of historical etymology and context.
Finally, we turn our attention to deep space. Canadian researchers revealed this month that they're detecting radio waves coming from a galaxy 500 million light years away. The radio waves are coming at consistent intervals. They arrive every hour for 4 days, then the signal goes silent for 12 days, then it starts up again. Evan was kind of hoping that our guests would explain that there's a very good chance that we're seeing a true alien signal, a sign of intelligent civilization. And that's exactly what many headlines concluded this week. So what the heck is happening here? Let's listen to Brian Koberlein, an astrophysicist and science writer with the National Radio Academy Observatory, and Roger Duby, an experimental physicist and professor emeritus with RIT.
Lots of natural processes create radio light. It's light. It's just a long, long wavelength of light that we call radio.
Whenever you accelerate an electron, for example, through some electric field, it emits radiation at a variety of different wavelengths. And so you're going to see some long wavelength radio emissions. You're going to see others, depending on the speed that that electron is traveling at, you'll see different sort of different distributions of wavelengths of things that it's emitting. And there may indeed be some sort of process that's going on where a molecule changes its state, emits an electron, and then you get a burst of radio. So there are a variety of different mechanisms that can create these things. And they can occur at any of a number of different wavelengths.
But they can travel that far for that long?
It's light. If nothing gets in the way, it's coming. I mean, radio wave is light. It's just a different wavelength.
So we are sending radio waves as well?
Oh, we've been sending them.
We emit radio waves all the time.
I mean, I know we are, but I guess what I mean is we're sending radio waves hundreds of millions of miles into space as well? Yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They get fainter the farther you go because it spreads out.
Like a flashlight from far away.
Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But we're doing that. Okay.
But we still do that.
The reason I think this one got so much heat is because of the pattern of the signals. It wasn't, hey, we detected more radio waves. It was every 16 days, it starts a four-day pattern of bursts on the hour, and then it stops for 12 days, and then it picks up the pattern again. Come on. Tell me what is doing the pattern like that.
There's a reason why in the movie Contact, when aliens...
Let's do this. Contact is a great reference point.
It's a great reference. The signal that came was both loud and non-periodic. So when the signal that was first detected was this loud burst that came in prime numbers. So it did 2 and then 3 and then 5 and so forth. And the reason it was that way is because periodic patterns are almost certainly natural. Periodic patterns are almost certainly natural.
We said that in the beginning of the program. I was saying it would be much more complex if it were an alien race. That's just a fact. You're going to get things that are very periodic if it comes from a natural process. You're going to get a rotating neutron star, things going around other things.
All right, but let's say you toss a garbage can down the stairs. Mm-hmm. It's going to make a bunch of banging sounds, and then it's going to stop. Versus you're working for the Houston Astros, and every 3 minutes you're banging on the can to send a signal to a batter. That's periodic. That's created. It's the randomness of the noise of something falling down the stairs that isn't periodic. I would think the civilized life form is periodic, I guess.
The sun rises about the same time every day. The seasons happen on a predictable cycle. Lots of things in nature are extraordinarily repetitive. Pulsars are a good example of this. These radio patterns that were just regular and all the time. They joked about them being little green men. They didn't think that they were aliens. But there was some process, some natural process, that just creates this regular pattern.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll catch you Monday.